Hi, I'm Vicky Taylor-Plain. I'm Communications and Marketing Manager at the University of Manchester and look after our environments and energy research. It's a beautiful sunny day out here in Manchester today, which is very apt as I'm on my way to the offices of three of our academics at the Photon Science Institute to chat to them about some exciting new developments in our solar energy research. I'm here today with Matthew Halsall, Tony Peaker and Ian Crow to discuss an exciting new breakthrough in solar energy research. Climate change is a grave issue and has been covered on the news quite a lot recently, obviously followed by the school climate strikes led by 16-year-old Greta Thunberg and the mass protest by Extinction Rebellion, who are aiming to really hammer home the message that many scientists have been telling us for a while now, that urgent action is needed to mitigate climate change.
What was also timely was this week's news article in USA Today and a couple of other publications on the fact that the atmospheric CO2 levels have again been recorded at the highest level in the history of humankind. Obviously very bad news, and that continues to grow.
The use of renewable energy sources, such as solar, is one area that helps reduce our reliance on polluting fossil fuels. So to start off, can you tell us a little bit more about the contribution solar currently makes to helping mitigate climate change?
Every year we're seeing the contribution from renewables on the whole being an increasing fraction to our installed electrical generating capacity both in the UK and around the world. We've just been looking at some numbers for the last couple of days, and in the UK now the contribution to our electrical generating capacity in the UK is about a third from renewables now, and that's a rapidly growing fraction. The contribution from PV is a smaller fraction of that, but that's because of the cost of generating solar PV has been driven down exponentially in recent years, certainly in the last 10 years or so. That driving down of the cost has helped to mitigate and open up PV to be an increasing accessible technology contributing to our electrical power generation.
I was chatting to a friend yesterday evening and we talked about this because she's quite passionate about environmental issues,
yeah.
And she was really shocked at the inefficiency of solar power when
yeah.
it's only sort of 20, sort of 18, 20%.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people aren't aware of that.
Absolutely, yeah. Not many people know, first of all, that some of the widely available commercial solar cells that you might install on your domestic properties, but also in large scale factories and things like that, they're typically 20% at best. Mm. The best lab based cells now are about 26-27%.
World records 28%.
World records 28% for silicon.
And if you do the calculation as to what's possible with a simple one junction cell, then the maximum theoretical possible is 30%.
It's never going to be better than that for silicon.
Within our lifetimes here, it probably will never be better than that. There are ways of putting multi-junctions, but it's so expensive that what really counts is the cost per watt.
That ratio is what matters.
It's the area of the earth that you need to cover. You need to use a material that's plentiful.
Yeah, well, you know, you have a lot of power from sunlight. You have, if you're at right angles to the sun, almost anywhere on the Earth's surface, you've got a kilowatt per meter squared. So even at 20%, you know, you've got 200 watts from a meter squared. So you can easily get up to a megawatt.
But it's probably worth pointing out, there's obviously a land use issue. Because if something is only 20% and you can only generate 200 watts every metre squared, then you need a lot of metre squares to start getting to megawatt power generation. Yeah. Well, actually, a couple of places are starting to look at, because land use is so critical, to especially certain places like Japan, islands like that, Japan have got a big programme to float solar, large-scale solar panels on the water, on the sea.
Or indeed in London, they have them on reservoir.
Yeah, well, we've got one here. Yeah. So Hyde Reservoir, just outside Manchester, which is run by United Utilities. I had the head of the renewable energy projects working for United Utilities come and give a talk to our students a year or so ago, and they've installed a floating solar farm on top of the reservoir to reduce their overhead costs. So they're using that technology for that. And there's articles about that in the Manchester Evening News.
What percentage would you say roughly solar contributes currently for the UK?
It's only about total of renewables. Mm-hmm. Is only about 8% of renewables. But one big problem with solar is that you only generate during the day, which is pretty obvious, but that's the case. And so you need to have some way of generating when the solar panels are not in operation. So that means some sort of backup that's needed. Now, many countries have what's called a pump storage system. So you have two reservoirs, one above the other, so that when the sun is shining, you can pump the water up to the higher reservoir. And that's fairly efficient. That's about 80% efficient overall. So that's one way of doing it. The other is to have, and of course this applies to wind as well, that if you have wind generation, that's intermittent. And you need some form of generation which you can turn on suddenly. And unfortunately, there are not many forms of generation that you can. Pump storage, hydro, is one. The really only other one is gas turbines. And although this is looked on very badly by the green lobby, and quite rightly so, that in the short term, gas turbines are a necessary evil for having renewable energy.
And they're less severe in terms of CO2 emissions than, for example, a coal-fired power station.
Okay, and we've recently got a week, haven't we, without any coal in the
UK? Yeah, that record's being broken year on year as well. It was a day to begin with a couple of years ago, and now it's a week. And, you know, that hopefully that will be increasing soon.
I think that the UK installed capacity is around 3% electrical generating, but it's much higher in Germany and some of the southern European countries.
Yes, I mean, the UK's record in renewables is actually pretty good. Compared to Germany, for example, Germany led Europe installing solar initially, but you know, again, the coal lobby has come in, and it's a very much larger proportion of CO2 producing generation than in the UK, and the same in Australia. Australia, which has the absolutely most ideal climate in the world for solar, and because of its very wide landmass across various longitudes, in fact you could make do totally with solar and wind, but coal dominates, and coal dominates for political reasons.
The other thing to say about the UK though is that whilst we don't think the UK has the ideal climate for solar PV, the important thing to note is that as the cost of generating power using solar PV goes down, it becomes more and more viable to use it in places where the climate is not, you know, that you don't naturally think, oh, that's, you know, a sunny place. It doesn't actually matter as much if the cost is low enough, because it's all about this dollar per watt ratio. So how many watts can you generate for every dollar you spend on electricity? And as the cost of that goes down, it becomes viable in places where you wouldn't normally think of installing PV.
Within 30 degrees of the equator, solar is by a long way the cheapest form of electricity generation now. And it's gone down remarkably quickly because of the learning curve. People know how to make things better, more efficiently, cheaper, natural learning curve that happens to all products. Also, technology has improved, and it's quite remarkable because if you talk about industrial scale solar now, the biggest single cost is the financing. The bank takes the biggest share, not the companies making the solar cell. Even if you think about domestic panels, then the cost of installation on your roof is more than the cost of the panel. So the cost has gone down absolutely dramatically, and it's now become the most rapidly growing form of renewable energy, most rapidly growing form of energy generation.
But I guess with it only being around 3% for the UK, maximising the potential of solar is really important. Mm. So can you tell us a bit more about the current issues on that front about solar power and getting the most out of solar energy?
The vast majority, 90% or more of current installations are silicon-based, that's the first thing to say. Silicon's a very plentiful element in the Earth's crust, it's very easy to mine it. The main drawback of silicon is that it's quite energetic to make a cell. It takes a lot of energy to make the cell in the first place because it's a very high melting point, hard material. And this means that it takes typically two or more years to get back the energy from the cell once you've installed it, as it takes to make. Is that less true than it was?
I think it's that was the figure if we go back 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
But the process of refining the silicon from sand, which is the main source of silicon, or quartz, the energy required has gone down for making the material by improved processes, so that it now takes less than a year to regain the energy taken in manufacturing. And you know, that's a good measure. Price is obviously very important, but from an ecological point of view, it's that energy payback time which is very critical. So 1 year, the expected life of a solar cell is now 30 years. You waste the first year simply generating the energy that you used in making it.
Well, I mean, they're guaranteed typically for 25 to 30 years to operate, but actually there's no reason why they won't operate longer than that. There are processes of gradual degradation, and one of those is the topic of this new paper, right? Mm. But actually, if a solar cell sits on a roof and it's cleaned and maintained well, there's actually no reason why the silicon itself won't continue to generate beyond that guaranteed 25, 30 year lifetime.
But of course you have limitations due to any old equipment, you know, corrosion of the contacts and issues like that. And of course that's something that is known, it's good engineering, people know exactly how to predict the life. And that's really where the 30 years comes from. But the degradation mechanisms are significant. And the one that we've been working on takes about 2% absolute, that's 10% relative of the cell, takes off 2%, and it happens in the first few days of operation. So really, a company selling such a cell has already taken into account that will degrade. What we've done, and people have worked on this for over 40 years, it's been known for 40 years that this exact process happens, and they know it's associated with the element boron, which is used as a dopant in the solar cell to make it conduct, and oxygen, which is there to give the silicon strength. The reaction that happens between those two occurs in a method that we've worked out, but in fact has not been obvious to other people before. And of course that gives the possibility of not just overcoming the problem, but guaranteeing that the problem won't come back over that 30-year period. A few people have managed to resolve a way of fixing it on an engineering basis, suck it and see job. And unfortunately, many of those have discovered that after a few months, the problem comes back and degrades. So I think what our research has done is to provide the arguments and the understanding that will make sure that the engineering solutions will actually last the life of the cell.
Many people are surprised to find out that solar cells are only 20% efficient in the first place, which doesn't sound a lot. Actually, for silicon, we're now at the stage where it's actually approaching what the best that it could ever be for that material system. So the fundamental limit is for single junction silicon solar cell is about 30% or so. And the best lab-based silicon solar cells now are at 27%, something like that. So it's not far off the best that it could be, in theory. So 20% actually doesn't seem so bad when you consider that 30 is the fundamental limit, right? And the other thing to say is that a 2% drop due to this, what's called light-induced degradation, which is, it's a reaction that takes place that forms a particular defect, but it's driven by light, which is obviously important for a solar cell because you're reliant on light to generate the electricity in the first place. So the solar cell's absorbing light, converting that energy into electrical power. This chemical reaction that takes place, which results in the degradation of the efficiency, is driven by the photons striking the cell. And so that's a key thing for a solar cell. We really want that solar cell technology to be stable under conditions of illumination and heating as well.
I think the other thing to emphasise is how conservative the community that makes solar cells are, that they're not going to dive into changing their process to use something other than boron and oxygen, because the way they look at it is, suppose it all goes wrong and our factory no longer makes cells that work, they will go bankrupt in a few months.
If you found a solution to this problem, there won't be any change to the current status quo unless the manufacturers of these things can be absolutely sure that your solution is the one that's going to work, because the risks are too high for business, and that's that point.
It's an incredibly competitive industry, and many companies have gone out of business because they were using old processes that didn't produce the efficiencies that today's processes can. That's very interesting, because the process that now has overtaken everything else was actually invented at a university, the University of New South Wales in Sydney. and they held the patents on it for many years and nobody used it. And developments that have enabled these massive improvements of efficiency have occurred only in the last few years. If you'd bought solar cells for your house 10 years ago, they would have been about 10%. It's a business that's changed absolutely dramatically.
So when we talk about these changes, we're talking about exponential changes in both improved, driving down cost at an exponential rate, driving up efficiencies at rapid rates, if not exponential. So this is what's responsible for the sudden emergence of solar cells and accessible to people on their domestic properties and not just businesses that can afford a huge investment. So now these things are accessible to individuals because of the cost has been driven down so much and the efficiencies are such that even in the UK it means that these are a viable option now for generating power for people, individuals.
It also means that the defect that we've found is a more of a problem than in the past because all the other problems have been solved.
Yeah,
that's if you look at it that way, is that people have solved nearly all the other problems, they're still left with this boron oxygen problem, which is still reducing the efficiency of the cells.
So people were aware that this was an issue for 40 years.
Yep, they'd observed it.
But they couldn't understand what was causing the process.
Yes, well, they knew that it was due to boron oxygen, and they knew that effect depended on linearly on the boron concentration and the square of the oxygen concentration, that it probably involved boron and two oxygen, but the actual microscopic form was a mystery. The normal techniques that we used to look at recombination just didn't seem to work, and so it needed a chance observation by Vladimir Markovich, one of our research fellows, to notice that there was a reaction between the boron and the oxygen which was very unusual and would be missed in normal measurement techniques. And he had sufficient experience to be able to extrapolate that. And so we discussed this as a possibility, and this is quite recent. This is really only 2 years ago that this happened. And then evolved a methodology to actually find out what the microscopic reactions were within the solid at an atomic level. And then working out ways that we could test this as a theory to see how it would work. And we had also a theoretical group at the University of Aveiro in Portugal, and that combination of various techniques to look at the methods that might be happening and then the theory to see whether those would be feasible eventually came up with what seems to be the solution to the problem.
There's also Belarus?
Yes, Belarus made some of the samples. We have a clean room facility for manufacturing these devices in the university, but to actually model the type of solar cell that suffered most from this problem, we needed collaboration from outside, and the people in Belarus were a contact that we've collaborated with for many years, and they manufactured these diodes for us. We're moving now to a second stage in this study, and the University of New South Wales, where the student who was central to this has gone to work now, are actually making more samples for us. We have to add, I think, that this isn't the only degradation mechanism that occurs in silicon solar. There is a much slower degradation mechanism that occurs. Its magnitude is dependent much more on the processing, and it happens not only in boron oxygen doped material, but in other materials as well, other methods of producing the cell. So that even moving to even if the industry was willing to move to another type of manufacturing, that there would still be this other form of degradation. But this form of degradation occurs in the boron oxygen in certain circumstances, and those are not well defined. But we know that this method of degradation is actually very significant over the 30-year life of the cell. But it does take 20 years or so for it to happen. And of course, that's much more difficult to study. There are ways of encouraging it to make faster by thermal treatments, trying to operate the cell at high temperatures, and accelerated life testing, I think people would normally refer to this. And we have ideas as to what causes that, and in fact that's our next project.
Fantastic. So yeah, never sort of resting on your laurels, but carry on.
No,
what's
the problem
next?
Still isn't solved, you know.
Yes,
until we get closer and closer to that fundamental limit of efficiency, then we won't be happy, you know, because that's going to continue to help drive the cost down of providing power through PV.
Can you tell me a bit more about the team that were involved in terms of the different disciplines and how the discovery kind of came together from the group of people that came together on this?
Well, we've had a group here in Manchester that looked at what we call defects in semiconductors, which has been here for 25 years or so. And that's leading in the world in that field. And so that was really the start of this study, using those techniques. The next very, very important stage was to then include various optical measurements, and so a technique called photoluminescence, which is shining high energy light and looking at the low energy light that's produced, and that provides a lot of information about what is actually happening in the electrical transitions to produce light, the opposite of what the solar cell does. So it's an inverse process, so that tells us a great deal about what's going on. And then we have theoretical methods which try to calculate what the lowest energy positions of the atoms will be during annealing, during the manufacturing, so how the oxygen in this case and the boron actually are likely to align in terms of their fundamental behaviour. And this has been, as I say, the area that this group in Portugal have worked on. And that has been absolutely invaluable in matching the experimental results that we've got to an atomic structure. And then, of course, there is the engineering side to it, that you have to make samples, you have to manufacture devices that are similar to the solar cell, but it's very difficult to take a solar cell. It's a secret process. The electronics industry is surrounded with secrecy. You know, the crucial part of any team at a university are the students.
And the research fellow, the postdoc.
This sort of work is, of course, very exciting for students, very interesting for students, and, of course, very important on a world scale. You know, it's very, very popular because they feel, we all feel, that doing something that will improve the lives of future generations.
Can you tell me a bit more about the PhD student who was involved in this?
Michelle came from Mexico. She's funded by what is called CONACYT, which is a Mexican organisation which pays for scientific research, but it funds some of their people to work in other countries. She came to the UK actually to work in a different area in Manchester initially, but she was also motivated to work in a field which she thought was going to help the world, and so she came to work with us.
I think it's important to say that she, as a PhD student, realised quite early on that the key to making a project like this successful was to accessing as many techniques as she possibly could to make lots of different measurements on the problem, so that she could then start to see patterns between the results that were emerging from these different techniques that she was able to use around, not just in her own department, but going to other departments around the university and speaking to people and saying, what is it about your technique that will give, what kind of information can I get about my material from using your technique? And would go and talk to people but very confidently, and then they would start to work together, and before you knew it, she was generating results from different departments all over the place. So I think that was quite an important...
You tried to introduce students to a whole range of techniques, which obviously is valuable for them in their future careers, makes them more employable, and in fact increases the interest of a PhD. I mean, I think the days of focusing on one tiny little area of study are over.
It's great, the opportunities there at the university to be in that environment where you have that opportunity to go out and do that.
This university, yes, in particular, and you know, that's encouraged by not just interdisciplinary, but I think multidisciplinary is a better word for it. For many years, the university has developed methodologies where people can work between departments, and hopefully that will continue in the future.
Well, this institute where we're sitting now, the Photon Science Institute, was built around that idea. It was trying to encourage engineers and natural scientists to come together to work together on, you know, perhaps share corridors and share coffee rooms and spaces where we could talk about our own expertise and our own experiences, come together and share those, and hopefully from that, you know, more kind of collaborative research projects emerge initially as investigative studies, interesting areas, and then hopefully to try and target formal support from research grants.
To come to Manchester to learn to be a scientist, and then now she's gone to work in Sydney.
The top photovoltaic institute in the world.
I quite like the story you're saying about the mix of ages as well, someone who's 68 working in the career, having that experience, and then kind of having that perseverance and determination coming together to...
That's right, so it's multidisciplinary, multinational,
multigenerational
collaborative research project, and I think that's probably the recipe for how you solve these problems. Michelle won the President's Award.
She's won the Faculty's Postgraduate Student of the Year Award.
Obviously, the next stage is to have an engineering solution to its elimination. And if you know what you're doing, you stand a much greater chance of that succeeding. And I think that we probably know enough about this reaction to say that we'll be able to find a solution to it that will last the 30 years.
It really is a milestone in the journey of solar cell efficiency.
The important thing is that we now know that it's an engineering problem. It's not a fundamental physics problem that is peculiar to, you know, doesn't have a solution. We now know that there will be a solution.
It's a bit like in knowing that if you hit the television in the right place, it starts working again, but not knowing what you're doing. You know, whereas if you actually know what the problem is, you can take the back.
You can fix it.
Fix it. Yeah, permanently. That's right.
And we've looked at some numbers, you know, and the loss globally associated with this degradation mechanism is around about 50 gigawatts of power that's lost. And if you set the context of that, that's equivalent to what 42 nuclear power stations can generate. 42 nuclear power stations the size of Sizewell B in the UK. So the most modern nuclear power station that we've got here. The installed electrical capacity of 42 of those, we've only got 15 nuclear power stations in this country, 42 of those is the same size as the loss of power associated with this problem. And that just gives you, it just sets the context for how big a problem this is. Well, that's the amount of power that you could generate from 42 power stations. It's the same as the amount of loss of power.
The thing is, the installed capacity is exploding. It's rapidly, very rapidly growing.
Yeah.
So the more quickly you solve this problem, the better.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
Especially because a lot of the older nuclear reactors are going to be decommissioned potentially quite soon.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that kind of sets a nice context, we thought. It's about the same, the loss in terms of power is about the same as the UK's total renewable energy generating capacity from all sources. The loss, when we talk about, you know, going from 20% efficient to 18% efficient, that might not sound a lot to people, but when you talk about 50 gigawatts of power lost through this process, and it's equivalent to the power that's capable of being generated by 42 nuclear power stations, then that really hammers home how big the problem is, right?
The biggest problem is if you start moving to having solar and wind more than 50% of the total generating capacity, you really have to have some cover for the intermittency of those two generating technologies. And as I have said, pumped storage is one, but
large batteries. You know,
well, batteries are horrendously expensive. EPSRC have recently launched a big program in battery development. Of course, it's not just the initial cost of the battery, it's the fact that batteries don't last very long. On a 30-year time scale, you'd have to renew the batteries four or five times. So it is a big problem. And that's, I think, from what little I know about battery technology, it seems to be, talking to my colleagues, it's a long way into the future before we're in the right sort of price range and in the right sort of life of the batteries.
So it's great that we've got funding, like the Faraday Challenge, and there's funding there. Do you think there's anything else from a policy perspective that can be done to help?
Well, they can bring back the subsidies for PV installations.
Well, you know, okay, that would, you know, the uptake of PV in Europe has dropped off with the removal of the subsidies. That's certainly true, but the subsidies were there, played an immensely important role. PV would never have taken off without the subsidy. It made this learning curve of the industry a realistic possibility. The subsidies, by creating a market, have brought the prices down, and that would never have happened without a subsidy. But I think it's debatable as to whether, you know, subsidies really would be significant now. Once you move to the situation where it's certainly in hotter climates, I mean, I mentioned 30 degrees from the equator, that's absolutely certain. But if you move to look at places that have good weather and are further from the equator, that not have constant cloud cover, then in fact they are certainly competitive with gas turbine and way cheaper than nuclear, depending how you cost nuclear. If you cost nuclear and include the decommissioning costs, or you include the financing costs that banks would charge for investing in nuclear stations, then solar is a small fraction of the price. Solar is a capital intensive system for generation, so the life is crucial.
To find out more about our energy research at the University of Manchester, visit manchester.ac.uk/energy-research. You can also Google research beacons. Online, you'll also have the opportunity to sign up to our mailing list to stay up to date on all the latest energy research developments at the university.